Welcome to Tampa Bay FM's Synergy Connection, where life as you currently live it can be transformed into the life you've always dreamed of. Understanding your synergistic connections is the pathway to your emotional, physical, spiritual, and mental wellness. Let's begin connecting the dots. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Synergy Connection Show. It's July the 25th, and I have as my returning guest, Bart Smythe, who makes his home in Sweden. It's been 5 months since I've seen you, so welcome back. As a refresher, Bart is a master practitioner of quantum medicine. He's also a grandmaster of Tai Chi and has trained people worldwide. He's also done sports massage, neuromuscular and structural alignment therapies, and he's available for private sessions, both in person and by Skype. In fact, he's going to be at Serenity Now today on Tampa Road doing some private sessions, some healing sessions. And I wanted Bart to kind of explain a few other things that he does so that he's more familiar with it than I am.
Well, I thank you very much. And it's really that with quantum medicine, you can address all things physical to mental, emotional, psychological, psychic, and spiritual. Yet I have a background in different psychotherapies that led to what was named Hakomi psychotherapy, which in the Native American language means, who am I in these many realms? But everything I do is with awareness and where the individual without some kind of psychoanalytic process or anything like that, but really just about being present and reflect with proper reflection and feedback, the individual can see for themselves their choices, and that when we can see our choices were made from our point of view, it was perfect at the time, then it just kind of like it's like a homeopathic, it just cancels out the situation. So I apply that with all my coaching and work and business trainings and things like that, where people get to be seen and see themselves and uncover that, our true self that gets covered, right?
Yeah.
From trying to fit in.
Right. I think the majority of people that I've certainly seen in private practice over the years, you know, they start out normally okay, unless they have been with mothers who maybe were under the influence of drugs throughout the entire pregnancy, which you and I talked about very briefly,
yeah. And
how that impacts a child. But generally speaking, you can be born into a pretty normal family, you know, hopefully with a mom and a dad and maybe some siblings. And it's only after you begin to hear the word no a lot, or don't do that, or, you know, fear-based kind of things that happen to little
criticism.
Kids. Criticisms, yeah. Emotional turmoil in the family that they're witnessing, that those layers begin to develop.
Yeah.
And it's a lot like any kind of shell, except our shells typically can be very thick because of years and years and years of messages that we're giving ourselves that say we're not enough, we're not good enough, we're not smart enough, we're not attractive enough, something that's going on. And so why don't you maybe share a little bit of what you and I were talking about before the show started?
Yeah, and I was thinking while you were saying this, my point of view, because it happened for me too, after many years of psychotherapy, I was sitting with one of the top trainers of Hakomi. I was blessed to be able to meet him when I did, because he'd quit all that and was project manager on Paris in Las Vegas, where I had my home office and Tai Chi schools and stuff years ago. And I could call them thick walls, but I would say cleverly constructed walls and management systems to succeed in business or whatever I was doing, but it didn't work for relationships. And he went straight through all of it in this one session with me, and it actually felt like I'd been, somebody had like first plugged me into 220, and then all of a sudden there was like this drain, and I go, how did you see that? Like, that's what the words that came out of my mouth. He goes, it's always easier for somebody, for me to see others than it is to see.
Oh, that's always true.
And so with that, he goes, you might be tired. And I go, I was wiped out. I just had to lay down. I passed out immediately because I'd been managing this. And really, it was that thought that I'm not good enough. But more than that, it was like, no matter what I do, the axe is going to fall. Somebody's going to rip me off. Or, you know, there's something wrong with me.
Right. That, and I've had so many people say they're always waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah. So. And that vibration, of course, we don't see it. I didn't see it because I was into high performance. Work harder, longer, get the job done, which made me good in construction, led me to having my own company, an architectural firm, but I didn't have a life.
Right, right. Your life was that life, but it wasn't on an interpersonal level.
Yeah, my Harley was my interpersonal level, and I my weekly vacation was driving across the Golden Gate Bridge, and I was like, oh, that was fun. Back to work. But, you know, having, you know, we can have the really obtuse conflicts at home, or we can have the isolation type of criticisms that take place at home, or just the lack of engagement and guidance. And this is a form of criticism I've seen, and I've seen it, as I was saying, I had this client whose mother was using drugs when he was in, and she passed. And his whole identity was, or his survival mechanism, I call it that because I can relate to it for myself, was trying to fit in, but not having been guided to be in first. And that's a process that in reflection, when I work with people, you've worked with so many people, and I've worked with myself and so many people. I've been working with myself since consciously since 86, 87 to like say, okay, maybe there's something I don't know because everything's working, but this part of my life certainly is a challenge. So, so I wanted to know. But without that initial connection that we were discussing this, and he had that because he was cesarean. He wasn't laid on his mother's belly. And what I've learned by birthing my own children at home and studying all these things, the moment after birth to be laid on the mother's chest, even before you break the umbilical cord, the child is doing a transference of information with the mother that can work on their enzyme building and other natural...
whole immune system is
exactly
there.
And all this information is getting transferred, and then if you get a cesarean, then the child's, you know, taken out, cleaned up, but the shock of not going through the shock of birth is actually kind of like that isolation thing. So you have this cushion, you didn't have that compression and release, which is so vital to our growth in life. I feel blessed that I was raised in the 60s facing Vietnam and a lot of racial violence and things like that, that we had these things that it just wasn't an easy walk to school, go to school and watch your cell phone. It was like, it was actually, you had to be alert.
Otherwise you were under the, like a fist or something,
well,
probably.
Yeah. And also, you know, we had something that was on TV every day showing, you know, the older guys going and things like that. So my mind was not just sitting calm, but it was another form of isolation. I want to get back to that. It's like the child's isolated at birth, but the mother's isolated from the child, so the hormones of loss are secreted, so the mother doesn't produce the same food-giving nutrients and stuff like that. It's all focused on the mother living. And so these are things that I work with people energetically, emotionally, through talk, I rarely touch people, but sometimes if people need to have that, it's done in a very energetic way. It's not like you don't even have to do a real physical hold or anything like that. But sometimes they just touch so they can come into their body.
Right.
Because they've been out trying to figure out the world from the outside and not looking in. Right. Because looking in can be too dangerous.
How many people have you encountered where that process of examining themselves, you know, like from the interior looking out through those eyes of, you know, multiple children actually reside inside of us.
Sure.
And so how many times has that process been too frightening for somebody to do? They just aren't able to do it yet.
I think by the time somebody comes to me and my approach is very safe and I have a lot of experience with people, I think I could say everybody's, I met, it'd be, I could say everybody, right? But also with the proper approach, which is not needing to have a result,
mm-hmm.
I don't go with a need for a result.
Mm-hmm. Well, they will find their own result, whatever,
exactly.
Yeah, wherever they're supposed to be.
And, but it's timing and clarity and things like this, then I think they're all ready, but they're, it's just like if I don't know what to do in my life,
mm-hmm.
right, I can watch YouTube, I can do non-important things, busy things,
mm-hmm.
but when I know what to do, forget about it, I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, there's so many things that I didn't know how to do other than work hard,
right,
or that,
right.
that I could avoid. And that came from a lack of engagement at an early age. I have other stories about my childhood, but what I wanted to say is the isolation thing, and then the survival mechanisms that they come in. And actually, I'm writing a book about my life and bringing in, it's kind of in a format that reveals the access. Well, I share my story,
mm-hmm.
which I do with a lot of clients because I have a very wide range of experience from.
Right.
We moved all over the United States, and my family was upper middle class, but we lived frugally. My dad was in the Depression, so I remember having to count toilet paper one time when,
okay.
Yeah, and it had to do with a drought, but also it was like, it was very strict.
You know, a lot of people that were children, not even necessarily of the Depression, but were raised by families that went through the Depression, because, I mean, there's different brackets of ages, but they always have that philosophy of waste not, want not.
Absolutely.
You know, and so everything, I've met people that are in their, you know, 80s, early 90s now that came through that. And, you know, it was like, okay, if you have scraps, you compost. But today, we typically live in condos or apartments or homeowners
yeah.
associations
right.
where you're not allowed to do some of these things. And so I think it's been hard for families making those adjustments from one cultural belief system into another. And now we have the millennials, and it's interesting to me, a lot of the millennials, although they, you know, are techie to the extreme, some of them are beginning to realize that life is really not all about getting things. You know, they're getting experiences more than they're getting actual items. You know, they're not into collecting as much. And even my son, and he's not a millennial, but even my son has begun to look at his acquiring process and telling himself, I don't really need as much as I thought I needed.
Hmm.
So that's an interesting process that's going on, I think, in the world today, too.
It is. I have children, 10, 15, soon to be 16 and 20 in Sweden. And
are they all different a little bit?
Oh, yeah, of course. But they've all been, they've been exposed to the overdose of technology and screen time.
Mm-hmm. And how do you limit that a little bit with them?
Well, unfortunately, I'm divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And we had different points of view on that. So that's actually why one of the reasons we are divorced, because it went overboard, and so how does that work with my 10-year-old? My 10-year-old is different. I don't think my wife at the time realized what was going on, And I traveled so much, and you know, I'm not putting it on her. We both, she had to do what she had to do, and my children were getting on it. We didn't know about the apps that you could limit, all that stuff. But then I would take the computer away, right? Done. You know, you got to do something to earn this back.
Right.
But then that wouldn't last. And so what I saw there was a lack of real-time consequences. And they live in a world somewhat isolated from, like what I was saying, in my life, I had direct and immediate consequences. Either at home with my dad. You know, nowadays, you can't hit your kids, which I don't hit my kids, but it's an option if they hit me. You know, but it never gets there, but they know it's an option because I just let them know that violence isn't an option, but whatever you do, if you hit your mother or me, it's going to come back. Maybe it's a reflex, I don't know. But that's how it happens in the world.
Right.
And I'm not saying this to be brutal to the world, but I'm just saying that they live, like in Sweden, they my daughter actually told me one time, well, it's against the law here in Sweden. I'll have you put in jail if, because she had hit my wife.
Oh.
And I said, well, good. Then we'll go down to the jail now, and I'll hit you in front of them. I'll go to jail because violence isn't in this house. And she looked at me. I said, yes, I'm serious. This doesn't go. Right? And then she goes, oh, and then that was the end of it.
And it never happened again?
No, it was like she just knew that I was serious.
Yeah. Well,
she
I
knows
think,
who I am.
I think adults and children alike need to always know that there are parameters. You know, that you can go up to a certain point, and if you go beyond that, that there are consequences.
Well, there will be consequences in the world, and that's what I grew up with. I mean, it was instant karma. In fact, I hadn't done anything, but it was karma from other lives, I'm sure. You know, I walked into school my first day in Los Angeles and got beat up going through the doors. And a week later, I got beat up by about five guys at my locker, and then I was a mark. Okay, go get Bart. And I was like, he's easy picking.
Dear.
But I don't want to go into the violence thing that much, but it was also... and intensely aware that as my children got further into their Snapchat and their other things, they had these statements that were going, their experiences weren't real experiences. They were talking about their experiences from what they'd seen on videos and experienced on videos, but they weren't getting out of their bedrooms to have an experience.
Yeah.
And now they're doing it. We got our children into more things. The blessing of my ex-wife is she's a professional with horses, and once we got them, you know, it's like the winter's one thing and then the summer and then that broke them free from that video lock that they were doing to be with horses and things like that. And that's,
horses are always therapeutic too.
It's changed their whole direction.
So now they have responsibilities.
They left the horses too for a while. They just buried into Snapchat and videos and all that stuff.
I remember you sending me a picture last winter, probably in March, maybe it was early April, but of a snowstorm, and the horses were there, and I think you were by yourself trying to take care of the horses while your daughter and your wife were on a cruise, maybe?
Yeah, I get back from Dubai, and it's like sunny, and it's warm, and they're going on, you know, it's 18 degrees Celsius, that's like 70 or 68, which is warm for Sweden at the time of year. They leave and a blizzard comes, and I have to go out in the forest. I first have to fill all these bags with hay and hang them in trees out in the forest because we have quite a few horses that will fight each other, so you put them out. That was actually amazing, walking through mud and snow, freezing.
And these are little horses. They're not like
great
big
ones.
Oh, are there some big ones too? I only saw the ones that were more like ponies.
Yeah, that was amazing. But so, yeah, the horses, that's therapy for me, too. And again, so we kind of drifted into that thing about my kids and stuff and videos. But it doesn't have to be that your parents are fighting all the time. There can be the silence
and the non-engagement.
And for me, it's not, I'm not a violent person, which I never hit my children. I don't have to. I've been training martial arts my whole life. I can give my intention. And that's what saved me on the street anyway, because after I really learned how to take care of myself, I just let everybody know that that was the outcome If they're coming for it, then fine. Mm-hmm. You know, the outcome is we're both going to get hurt, or one of us is going to be more hurt, but I'm not here to prove anything, but I'm going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody look at me and go, oh, well, maybe we'll go over here.
Right.
Yeah, it didn't happen too many times, but, it, you know, people know the weak fish gets jumped. And that's one thing. My children are now coming to me. They're training karate. I don't teach my kids martial arts.
Mm-hmm.
But I go to school with them. I'm learning karate with my 10-year-old again.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah, so it's like, it is. I'd like to be the student. But I just wanted to make that clear that there's this isolation, or there's this lack of pressure and release that you can feel the sensations of it in one of these movies like Iron Man or something like that, where you're, all the sound and the videos are going, I'm sitting there in my chair, but grinding my teeth. I go, oh, geez. I come out, but it's not a real experience.
Right.
And I think you're right that there's a change coming or here with the food choices and the yoga and all that other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going inside and activating that.
Right. I'm finding it actually very fascinating because a lot of the guests that I've attracted to the show are all there, and they're all different ages. So it's almost like this awakening that's taking place at various age levels, and yet everybody's on the same path of looking at relationships and the importance of spending time with each other, of having experiences with each other. Whether it's, you mentioned building a, I think you said a treehouse.
My son called me at 4 in the morning because he misses me.
I think that's awesome.
And he asked me if I was going to build a treehouse with him when I get home. I go, yeah. Of course.
So now you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean,
just being there.
Oh, absolutely.
That's it.
I have a friend that I do things with, and I know a lot of times when we're, you know, at different locations, we never know what we're going to see. It might be this amazing grasshopper, or it might be a spoonbill, or it might be, you know, a tree that is, you know, just absolutely perfect. But it's the anticipation, in a way, of, I don't know how to explain it other than like a little bit of a journey. So you take a journey, you don't know what's around the bend, and then you have this anticipation of something will be absolutely amazing. And it always is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can do that with little ones. You know, my grandson, when he was, oh gosh, maybe 3 years old, he used to visit us in Green Bay. And he had a really, really good imagination.
Yeah.
And so we were on 5 acres. And so I had, we had lawn care. And periodically I would have them take a bush hog and go through 2.5 acres that we didn't mow or do anything else. It was just wild.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would grab him when he would come to visit from Chicago. And I would say, okay, last night the Indians were making noise out here. So let's go see if we can find their camp. And we would, you know, like he would creep along, and then I would stop and I would say, do you hear him yet? You know, and he totally got into it.
Yeah.
And so I think we can do that at any age in our life.
Absolutely.
If we stop being so adult and recapture that innocence of, I want to discover life. And so many people are caught up in other aspects of achievement or something like that, that they forget. They just forget to be the kid.
And I think that's the, when you were saying that, I was thinking one of the things is like being a good parent. And I see parents wanting to be such good parents. I'm hiking in the mountains where I used to climb as a kid,
mm-hmm.
and there was nobody. It was illegal for us to be there. They've opened it up now outside of, in Altadena, it's called Eaton Canyon. We used to climb over the top of the mountain, and you know, we'd be on places where a lot of people died. Actually, it was decomposed granite, so you could be standing on a rock and could,
oh my gosh, and it would just slide.
It would just go away. So a lot of kids lost their life, but we were all over that place when we were kids, and I think about it, made some really moves that, thank you God, I didn't go,
mm-hmm.
but I'm walking on the flats by the creek, and these parents are going, okay, now be careful, there's a stone here, and then there's going to be a root, now watch out. And these kids are like going like, yeah. But I thought, well, that maybe she's nervous. Then I heard another mother saying the same thing, and the father's yelling at him to be careful, and it's like every step, and I'm going, wow. I mean, that would be painful to be that worried about my child just walking down a trail with some stones and stuff.
Exactly.
And I'm going, and that's what I wanted to get to. What I was saying is, like, in my life, my parents never knew where I was. And when I got beat up, it was my dad said, well, learn to walk away or run. And I said, well, they surround you, man. It's always fire. And he goes, well, I don't know what to say. But at home, there was a swift correction.
Uh-huh.
And it could either be yelling or the other. And what I saw was I didn't want to be like my dad, because he could really, that correction could be pretty strong. Red butt, you know, uh-huh. type of thing. And so I didn't want to shock my children, but I wanted to be a good parent. And I thought about that. And I actually realized that I don't know what it is to be a parent other than to enjoy the presence of my child.
Uh-huh.
Right? And then I started just doing that.
Uh-huh.
Right? Instead of trying to be a good parent, because my job does take me around the world, and when we could homeschool, it was fine. My family traveled with me, all, then all of a sudden,
right.
Sweden made it illegal, and they've got this incredible school system now where you have to take a test every week. You know, it's like unbelievable. The
Doesn't
pressure.
That produce a lot of anxiety in the kids there?
Yeah, my daughter, who was having a ball, and when they got, yeah, the Montessori and other schools, they were doing great, and mm-hmm. then they got into that system, and she had, both of them went into shock and trauma, and I think that's part of why they went into the video and stuff like that, too.
Escape.
Yeah, escape. And but the other thing is, like, there's so many regulations and rules on being a parent, but and I'm not for any form of abuse. I'm not. I want to put that out there again. But it's limiting if we can't just be ourselves with our children.
Right.
And my fear was to be in conflict with my child because I didn't want to lose their connection.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then I found out that when I really said no, absolutely, with my 15-year-old, I said no way, and I didn't. There was nothing in Sweden to support me, and we made an agreement. I flew her to my son, who was in the military, and he's a jiu-jitsu teacher, just about, and a great guy, but engages you and makes sure that you're not hiding.
Mm-hmm,
right,
mm-hmm.
You can't hide in his house.
Mm-hmm.
And she really, she went from wanting to do eyelashes and eyebrows and drive a truck in Sweden, right? This genius artist, she's just amazing. Which I'm not criticizing that, but there was, you know, I just said, well, that's a good job too. I mean, fine if that's what you like, I support mm-hmm. that. But she came back after being engaged. And listening to a lot of Jordan Peterson, my son would have those guys. I don't know if you know him, but he's fantastic. I like him. Now she wants to get her PhD in criminal justice.
Wow!
And all
that's
the,
a big change.
Yeah, and all the friends that she had that were smoking and drinking and stuff. Yeah, in Sweden, they just let their kids smoke and drink at the age of 15, 16. It's like they don't care. I go, what? No way.
Hmm. Yeah. And do they want to do, you know, like criminal justice in Sweden or someplace else?
No,
okay.
She wants to go back to the States.
Oh, okay.
She feels more aligned with the United States. But the main thing was she came out of this place because my son could engage her.
Mm-hmm.
And for me to engage her, of course, I came with all my fears and doubts because I didn't know what to do with the video thing. I didn't know. I don't care if you smoke and drink, try it. I mean, everybody does that, but it's not going to become a lifestyle that's
mm-hmm.
that's accepted.
Right.
My dad didn't, but he didn't mind once I was old enough to smoke and drink. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, that, I grew up in that age.
Right.
So.
It seems to me like a lot of parents, and this has been true over the last, I'm going to say 40 years, because they didn't want to be like their mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to be friends.
Mm-hmm.
And you lose respect as a parent.
Exactly.
When you become their friend.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Not with me, but that's what happened.
Yeah.
And I want to say, it's not that the parents allow it, but there's so few ways to be a parent because there's so many state controls there. You know,
mm-hmm.
socialism. And it's not.
Well, tell me something. This is in the news now, and I actually had a friend tell me about this about a month and a half, 2 months ago. There are people that are actually opting to have a microchip put in their hands, and they'll use that for currency. Just swipe their hand.
In Sweden?
In Sweden.
Oh yeah, they're pretty
That's crazy.
I'm
just thinking, if you didn't politically
they
agree,
started it. They started it with a club,
mm-hmm.
that you, it was a membership thing.
Mm-hmm.
They just soft entry it,
mm-hmm.
and you know the. You know that, like it's all coming out now. All the mental programming and stuff that was on Facebook and
mm-hmm.
YouTube and Google. They have all these ways of using algorithms to lean you in a direction, and I watched it. I got off Facebook a couple of years ago. I felt sick every time I was on there with my company. I just, not the people, but it was just
mm-hmm.
the information. I'm very sensitive to it, but Sweden, you know, I don't want to speak too bad about Sweden because it's got so many great things, but they also have this opinion there that they don't want to be racist, they don't want to be this, they don't want to be that, but then they've brought in, now we have 50 cities where you can't, the police are afraid to go into. Yeah. And,
wow.
And rape of young children is way up, young boys.
Oh my goodness.
We had 3 murders a year, now it's like 3 a week. And
that's because the police don't want to go in?
Well, it's because the migration, they've let all these people in from Syria and Afghanistan and other places.
Okay.
And they.
It was an open door policy.
Yeah. Now they want to change it. They see, but the results are there, and then how do you get them out?
Exactly.
Because they're
on
the social system.
Germany's had that problem, too.
Yeah, so the but they all did it out with the greatest good in mind.
Yeah, humanitarian, right.
But it's like, to go against that, it's almost like it's really the lemming thing I see. And I was a lemming with the rock and roll and all that other stuff, so I'm not
go
above.
Over the cliff?
Yeah, I went over the cliff with rock and roll and beer, and you know, I just had a rope caught me before I hit the ground. But I definitely, you might see that, but there's another underlying awareness in Sweden. The younger generation is going, no way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and the parents are now getting very angry and upset that I talked to business owners and stuff
mm-hmm.
there. And
you know what's happening, which you just because you're in Sweden, you'll relate to this because it's happening in San Francisco. And I'm talking to police officers, actually, in San Francisco that have said they cannot believe in the last couple of years what's happened there. And I love San Francisco.
That was my home, yeah, for a while.
I absolutely, but the homeless are on the streets.
All my friends
they're,
have left. All
yeah,
my friends have left. They got,
they're,
yeah.
you know, they're peeing, they're defecating on the streets. They can't do anything to change that because
your car
so
gets
much.
Broken. If you're not in a protected thing,
yeah.
it's like, bam.
Right.
In and out in 30 seconds, right?
Right. So, I mean, these are officers that are saying they can't wait to retire in the next couple of years because they're leaving.
And that's the thing is, like, everybody wants to keep their job, so they get pulled into this deal
mm-hmm.
that is really, I don't want to go political.
Yeah.
I know what it is. I mean, I grew up, you were going to ask me about my, how I became a...
Yeah, how you became a shaman, and I think we need to do that.
Okay, well, life experience. But I'll just kind of fast track through my youth and stuff was that I was always sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
I had things happen that I could almost feel like I could communicate with birds or monkeys. And you know, like when we went to the zoo, I would make sounds like the birds, all these exotic bird sounds my parents said. You know, I'd be making them in my throat and stuff like that. I don't know if I can do it now, maybe, but they would laugh at me. I'd go to the monkey cage and I'd be talking to the monkeys, and some my dad goes, I've never seen anybody piss off monkeys as much as you have. Yes. Monkeys going crazy trying to get me and stuff.
And you didn't know what you were saying to them?
Oh, I think I did. I mean, I've always been a joker and a bit of a wise guy, but just really I had things happen in my life that opened the door to see that I was alone.
Hmm.
Right? I saw that the police weren't there to protect me. I saw my parents couldn't protect me at school. You know, nobody knew.
And it was up to you.
Nobody knew what to do with the racial violence. We were the first busing.
And that was in Los Angeles, right?
Pasadena.
Pasadena,
yeah.
Yeah.
And so the older guys were all hippies, and you know, so they started giving my friends that had older brothers in that marijuana and other things. So we kind of went into that realm of things to have fun. Just kind of fast forward, I had a crazy life where I trained and saw myself going to NAM, and I didn't go. And the only reason I would go is my dad told me he'd kill me if I didn't go, because after Milai, I said, you know, this doesn't seem like the war for me, you know.
Right.
And he just said, you can't send somebody else in your place. And I thought, oh, okay, you're right. So then I really trained with these guys that were coming back. But then I also was a happy-go-lucky doing my thing, playing tennis, going to college, going, I was going to be an oceanographer. And then I just didn't have what it took to stay in a smoggy city anymore. I had to get out to nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Santa Fe, and there's all this Indian culture there. Mm-hmm. And I'd always studied the Native American. I was raised with an archaeologist too, Charlie Stark. So I've been on digs in Texas, and we lived in the Iroquois Nation in New York. So this was always in my consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in a bar in the first time I got approached by Indians, I was in a bar in Pecos after helping a friend move out of the mountains up there. And we were mud from head to toe. I had long hair and a beard at the time, and just freezing. We stopped for a steak and some shot of whiskey and beer before we hit the road. And I'm sitting there, and there's this Hopi Indian. You can tell the difference. And I'm sitting there going, he's staring at me. And I go, George is an Indian staring at me. And George is an ex-Green Beret. And he goes, and I'm the, but he goes, this, well, that's cool. Just let me know if he comes over. Yeah, I said, he's coming over here now. And the guy comes over, and he looks at me, he holds his hand out like this, says, this is for you. And I held my hand, and he gave it to me. I said, what's that? He goes, it's peyote, mescaline. And I go, oh, thank you. But it was in a shape I'd never seen it. It was just powder and stuff, so I didn't do it properly, but I wasn't doing it for any spiritual purpose. I didn't even connect it. Why is this Indian giving it to me, you know?
So he recognized that part of you that was...
Yeah, I mean, why is he there? He's standing in a corner. I come in. I watch everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then he's watching me the whole time. Then another thing happened. The head spiritual guy of the Paiute Nation, Marion Three Hawks, was waiting for me at my mom's house. I came home like at 1 o'clock in the morning. He goes, yeah, I've been wanting to meet you. Because I was in this club, and then these guys pulled knives on each other, and then these other guys tried to break it up, and I threw one guy across the wall, and I knocked the other one down on the ground, because it's when knives are flying, then it's the innocent that get cut.
Right.
And one was a friend, one was another guy trying to be a hero. And then I did it so fast that the knife fighters looked at me, and then they quit fighting. And this Indian was there, and Marion had been in the Bay of Pigs, Korea, and Vietnam. And anyway, he wanted to talk to me. He said, I've never seen anybody move like that. And I was trained, and I was very fast, but I was also scared of people getting hurt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never, but I didn't do it to hurt people. I just did it to protect people. I was the Boy Scout. Anyway, so those were my first things. And then we became blood brothers. And throughout the night, we talked about, he taught me everything about Custer's Last Stand and all these other things that are in the Indian books. There's like 3 books of them that he, and I became an honorary member of their tribe. I could come to the Taos Pueblo anytime and you'd fish in their lake, which is only for native. And I'm just like, I'm just, okay, I'm not thinking. But
uh-huh.
Then things happened in my life that were absolutely in another realm. And, you know, I was exposed to people that did child abuse. And these were priests and senators, and I married into a family. And this affected my family. And, you know, being where I came from, my dad whipped me a couple times when I was a kid with a belt, and he slapped me, but I knew he loved me and he was safe. Right,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was just to get my attention.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So this really became something that was a challenge for me.
And this is all in your book that you're writing, right?
I'll put that in there.
Yeah,
yeah. And I had to deal with something that I couldn't believe had occurred. B, I didn't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And C, it affected me directly. So I
And that's kind of a helpless feeling, I think, when all of those things are happening.
It was helpless, but it was also so shocking to me to be present to that with supposedly high-level people, you know, that you should be respected. And I'm thinking, mm-hmm. you know, I'm this kid from L.A. that, you know, I came from good stock. I have good principles, good values, and all that other stuff. But I, on a scale of here to there, where you could say, you could set your sights, these people have produced something with their life that was beyond me, mm-hmm. right, at that time as a young man. I looked mm-hmm. up to them, right?
And then you found out.
And then I looked at, wow, you know, this is bad. This is really bad. And I couldn't even think of how, there was no management system in my system. I mean, violence doesn't, I couldn't do anything to protect or take.
And there's no explanation either, I think. You know, sometimes you can explain things away as to, well, this happened or this happened, but there is a point at which you can't explain it. Mm. And sociopathic tendencies, you know, like a lot of times I will see just this enormous cruelty to animals, which I know what that means.
I can't take that.
Yeah, it bothers me tremendously.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's like, I can watch people get hurt, but when I see an animal get hurt. Anyway, so what happened was I left Michigan and met with my best friend. We started our company in San Francisco, and we built the house for my best friend's ex-girlfriend's husband. They were still close, and he was a psychotherapist from Israel and a shaman. He trained with many wonderful, you know, Timothy Leary and all these other guys were part of that. You know, Stanislav Groth, Ron Kurtz, and then Dr. Roquette out of Mexico. And I'm building their house, right? And I'm thinking, well, this sounds really interesting what you guys are doing. And they didn't tell me the whole thing. But I said, you know, I had a meeting with them, and I said, you know, this is really just really affecting me. And I don't know what, so I'm driving down the road working all day long, but I'm going, I have this thought going, how do I do this? How do I, and I just drive myself nuts. So I went into therapy. And that was a combination. They were doing the medicine plants of Oaxaca, the Maria Sabina. Maria Sabina, the mushroom woman, trained my teachers. And Dr. Roquette, they put a Western modality onto that. So I started with that, and it was like the first time I worked with them that way. It was like it just became clear on everything. Everything just went whoosh. And then I was free from this, somehow or other, thinking I had done something wrong by not being able to be there to know about this type of abuse.
Sure.
Because it happened in a church with my oldest daughter. So.
Okay.
And you know, first instinct is you want to kill the person, but then you know, it's the second one, you don't know who it is.
Yeah.
And the funny thing was, after years of getting it all straightened out, then we found out the whole family, everybody in the family, with babysitters and all kinds of stuff. Then this whole thing was, it's like a, I don't know.
It's like a cult.
Yeah, I don't know. Because I'm out of, I just found out later on from all this.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, so then step by step, I got more clear and I got away out of therapy and I went out and I trained in many different things, like life purpose and living your, you know, like we say, what are you the Picasso of? And that evolves out of this system of trainings we do. And then that was very important for me. And then I came back to train with my teachers and I met this guy. I was blindfolded, but I felt him enter the room. And he was the Ayahuasca for 25 years, lived with the...
Now, what is that, actually?
Ayahuasca, he's a curandero shaman.
So he was a high-level one, though.
Well, he was probably considered the only, you know, Michael Harner and his guys came down. Well, not Michael Harner, but one of his top guys came down with me and Kenny to Peru. And Kenny took me there after a couple of years of working with me. Because I just had this sense, this is the guy I need. And Kenny had
And he just came.
Well, he walked into the room and I was in this session blindfold, but he was such a powerful energy. And I picked my blindfold up and I looked and I saw he walked like a martial artist.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing that goes through my mind is, I go, this guy's going to kill me. And I put my little paranoid growing up. And so anyway, in a way he did, because he took me to places I needed to go, and I got involved with ayahuasca to heal myself. And
so when you actually say he's going to kill you, he killed a part of you that was no longer serving you.
Yeah, well, he knew me because I was like him. He was a high-level ninjutsu, and I was, I can't say that I was the most highly skilled technician, but I had great skill and technique and a lot of experience, and I had crazy, like in the movie the guy said, I'm a black belt. Yeah, well, I'm crazy.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't have any fear after I'd been beaten so bad, so I just, I could look at people.
Bring it on.
Yeah, I said, yeah, if you want to do it, I'm fine. You know,
goodness gracious.
I'm not going to let anybody hurt me anymore. So that, anyway, he had that, and he was able to be with me with that, and...
So what is ayahuasca? I know you have to be very careful that you're with
somebody. Extremely careful.
Yeah, because there are people today, and in fact, I've had you talk to a couple of them, but there are people today that are quote-unquote, you know, come with me and we'll do a ayahuasca weekend. And I'm like, no, you do not want to do that unless you know the person exceptionally well.
Well, the technology that we use in Peru is very exact and it's precise and it's magnificent and it's impeccable. And I was trained by them. And the training, you can't learn. It has to be delivered to you over many nights and many healings and many times. And so I didn't even know I was being initiated, but I was down there with, as I say, Michael Harner's right-hand guy, and then these other people that were all from the psychotherapy community. And we were all therapists.
So they knew.
Yeah. So everybody was... The Indian asked me if I wanted the higher levels through the translator, Don Benjamin, asked me, and I said, yeah, that's what we're all here for, right? And he spit in his hand, and then we shook hands, and the translator, he says, after tonight, there's no going back. I go, okay. But I still, even at that time, I didn't know what he was doing, and years later, I found out I was the only one that they did that with.
Really?
Yeah, and I talked to him about it later on with Kenny, and he said, yeah, well, this is how it works. And then we went into it. And I still didn't know really what was happening with me. But I knew the last moment that it was, that the last moment, the last part of the initiation, everything combined, and I just knew. And I knew not to move a muscle. And he just said, don't move, this is it. And all of a sudden he was in my ear. Don't move. And so that's when he gave me the last piece. And then
and what happened, you know, when he did that?
Well, you know, in the moment, it was just a knowing that I didn't know anything and not to move. Just let take place what was going to take place. And it was very, still, it was not a big experience. I'd had some, and we're not about a big experience. It's really about getting the work done. And it's impeccable work and it's fantastic work. But yes, I've had clients of mine that went to Stockholm, and the guy even said, I'm not a shaman, but here, right? And then she calls me a month later, she's got things in her that, you know, because you're not around somebody who can manage that and navigate that and protect the space.
Right.
And so...
It's like an entity actually can move in.
She was possessed. And she went...
My understanding is if you don't use a protection... on a daily basis, as you open yourself up to these energies.
Well, see, that's the thing. You know, mine wasn't a weekend thing. This took over years.
Mm-hmm.
It took years and a lot of communication and a lot of. I mean, Teddy Kenny would, you know, he didn't really talk. I mean, I could fly in a couple times a year and, you know, we'd sit and we'd do it. I'd look at him and say, "How you doing? Good to see you. It's good to see you too. It's okay. I work with you now. You know, when we're in the ceremony, we do that. It's, how's that? It's good. Okay. Thank you." And that could be the whole thing. I might not even talk to him before I leave more than eat a little chicken and go. There's nothing to say. It's just done. But you know it's done.
Right.
And when you're done, there's nothing left undone.
Right.
Right. You don't walk out in the world and get hit by whatever, the psychic energy. So it's like a martial art. You develop yourself from the inside out, and these things have no... I don't challenge anybody, or I don't challenge spirits, because they're all part of life, but I'm not here to hurt them, and also I'm not here to be hurt, so, but yeah, I caution everybody.
Almost like right now, a lot of this is like the end thing to do. And it's being marketed that way, like have a weekend and experience highs you've never felt before.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. And it worries me because, like I said, I've sent a couple of these people to talk to you because I was like, no, you do not want to do this.
Well, one person did get something in her. I got it out of her.
Good.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's like, you know, I don't want to jump in the ring without the proper training. I don't want to get my head knocked off, right?
Right.
Then I don't want to get trained by somebody who hasn't experienced real combat before. You know, he didn't read a book and train in a dojo and never take a punch to teach me how to handle it.
Right.
And so with this, it's very, it's a blessed situation, and people always get what they go for. So even if they're going to do it that way that doesn't have the integrity that the plant actually calls for, that type of integrity. Once you get involved with working with these technologies down in Peru, there, you know, it's like Lady Ayahuasca, the spirit of the vine. You know, it's like my teacher said, she's very, you know, she's very exact. And if you step out of your integrity, she'll bring you back.
How does she bring you back?
Well, it could be many different ways. It could be a slap. It could be a real situation that shows you just how wrong you're going.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just say that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So one of the things that I guess I have experienced with clients over the years is sometimes, and I wouldn't involve ayahuasca necessarily, but sometimes we're presented with something in our lifetime, and we might be 10 or 15 or 20 or early on in our life. And if you don't learn that, I'm going to call it a lesson, but if you don't learn from that experience, then it'll repeat itself.
Absolutely.
But it'll be a little more intense the next time.
Yeah.
And then if you don't learn it then, it'll repeat itself. And so I've had people, and I know you have, that are in their 50s and 60s in particular, and they're going, what the blank, you know, my life is in the toilet, and what is going on? And it's because they never, ever took the time or the energy or the understanding to figure this out.
And I think, and that's why I have trainings that clarify this, but that's, you know, you go through your life thinking, well, there's something wrong here,
mm-hmm.
so I'm going to correct it,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm going to correct it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I trained to gamble with a master psychotherapist who's actually world famous. I'm not going to name him right now because I don't think he wants everybody to know that he's mastered that too. But he taught me how to gamble in Vegas. He came to train with me.
Really?
Yeah, in martial arts. And then he came for private lessons. He's very adept with weapons. He's a loving guy. I mean, he grew up, his father was mafia in New York and ran the games, and
mm-hmm.
So he learned the horses and the games and all. But anyway.
So when he shows up in Vegas, do they go watch him?
No, there's no way to stop him.
Okay.
I mean, it's quantum physics.
Okay.
I've been at the dice table with him, and he goes, he's going to roll a 10. The guy rolls a 10. How do you know that? So then I start betting with, because I just know it.
Yeah.
But nature's always seeking a balance. But
mm-hmm.
What you saw with the gamblers, you know, somebody could come in and everything's in patterns, right? And I'm
mm-hmm.
not trying to teach gambling here, but you'll see a long streak on the baccarat table of banker, 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 and somebody will come in and see like maybe six or seven bankers on the tote board, and they'll start betting player. I've seen this happen. And the guy, then you have to double up with your money management. If you lose one, then you got to bet three. Right?
Uh-huh.
Da, 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 da. And then I've seen people ask for a note, you know, because they have credit at the casino. They're high rollers. They'll bet 10 times in a row losing, and then it comes over to player and they go, I won!
Wow.
It cost me $60,000 to win five.
Yeah, really.
Yeah,
right.
But it's like they don't see, but they're trying to correct,
mm-hmm.
right? Thinking that they have to be right to be, but really it's that need to be right that doesn't allow us to be wrong to just, and that's what I think the medicine did for me. It was just, I collapsed. And just real a quick story, because Kenny was the bodyguard to the last living ninja that came over here.
Mm-hmm.
And he's having this talk with me because I'd always been on this quest of power. I kept training, actually where it led me to very dangerous people and dangerous times to train. It was
mm-hmm.
like, I go, whoa, these guys are a little off the edge. So I backed out of that. But Kenny, said, you know, everybody, all these tough guys are going, you know, what's the one move? What's the one thing, right?
Right.
And I'm sitting there going, yeah, what's the one? And he could see me. I'm leaving, sitting on the edge of my chair waiting for that one technique. He goes, be the pussycat. Everybody loves the pussycat. And I almost fell going, oh, what do you mean the pussycat? And Kenny just put his hand on my shoulder and laughed. He goes, I know, it's the same way. Right? You're always looking for something to be better than the next guy, and there's always going to be somebody better instead.
There is.
But when you learn about who you are, which the journey of shamanism is that, really, mm-hmm. and you don't need medicine for that. You don't need to do ayahuasca for that.
Right.
That was my path, but, you know, I'm grateful I went there. I guess this, you know, it was, but I wanted to say this is, like, I feel like Forrest Gump. Everywhere I went was, I got led to wonderful people, but I was just following what the moment led to.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody I saw, even with the psychotherapist that we were with that wanted to be like my teacher, I never wanted to be. I wanted to be a successful architect builder.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't looking at that. But everybody who went for that crashed.
Hmm.
Right? They went to be something instead of it was their true nature.
Right. And so they never discovered themselves.
Yeah, and their true nature is their path to shamanism.
Yes.
Right? That's when you're aligned with everything.
Right.
Yeah. Like Don Benjamin told me, he says, you know, the jungle's screaming at you, Bart. But you're not listening.
Right.
You can't hear. And I'm going.
Right.
Then I'm sitting there going, okay, I hear the monkeys.
Yeah.
But the jungle's in me.
Right.
I couldn't hear.
You couldn't hear.
I was too busy in the outer world trying to figure out how to get along.
Right.
And so that's what I'd like to say to everybody, because shamanism looks good. People talk about these great adventures. That's the other thing. In our work, you're never supposed to tell about what goes on, because that's
mm-hmm.
yours.
That's yours, yeah.
Yeah, so we don't talk about it, you know. And I did one time, my teacher told me not to, one time I did with a group, I shared my experience, and I felt completely depleted afterwards, and I go, oh. I talked the whole thing away.
Mm.
So
have you got a title for your book yet?
Yeah, Life and Times of a Modern-Day Shaman. I wouldn't believe it if I didn't live it.
I like the title. I do.
Thank you.
And it's going to come out in 2020?
Absolutely, if not before. I mean, it's coming really fast now. I was having a hard time because I'm always growing, and I'd be giving my story and the experiences and what I got out of it then, but then all of a sudden while I'm doing it, then in my daily writing, I'm getting another picture and another growth spurt,
mm-hmm.
and then I have another book for that, and then I have another book, and I go, oh yeah, I got to put it all in one. So
all
it kept me from completing, and I guess I wasn't ready either, but I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really coming in a good way, and it's, yeah.
I think that's going to be very exciting. You'll have to make sure that we stay posted, you know, with the outcome of it.
And I know why I want to do it now, too. That's the other big thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, our hour is basically gone.
That was fast.
And it was very fast. It always is. So I want to leave everybody with the information that, you know, Bart can be found online at
bartsmythe.com. BartSmythe, bartsmythe.com, and I will be doing more programs in the United States, and I'm in Europe, Dubai, Saudi.
And the fact that you're available,
they can contact you through that website.
Okay.
Everything, even the most weird stuff that I've talked about, we do on Skype.
Okay.
We can get it all done.
That's terrific. This afternoon, I know you're at Serenity now.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have scheduled appointments for healings with
people.
Yeah,
I'm booked.
And I'm going to introduce you to a friend who does some amazing woodworking after that.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So that'll be exciting for you. Your brother's from a different mother is the way I'm going to refer to this.
Cool.
Because you will absolutely adore each other.
Thank you.
And in the meantime, if you missed the show, you know, a friend, maybe a family member needs to hear this show, please go to synergyconnectionradio.com. And you'll find the show up a little later this afternoon. They are archived there, so you can go at any time that's convenient, and the shows are all listed there. Keep in mind that this is a physical, spiritual, mental, and emotional. That's why I refer to it as the Synergy Connection Radio Show, because we are actually all four, and if any one of those pieces is not functioning the way you would like for it to function, either get in touch with me through that website. Also take a look at the Boomers Forever Young products. that will help with your physical well-being. Thank you for joining me today, and I hope everybody has a beautiful, I know it's a rainy day out there, but a beautiful day nonetheless. And please make this your best life.